Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm going to talk about yoga today, once considered an exotic Eastern discipline and then a mainstay of the upper class and Hollywood lifestyle. Yoga in its many iterations now is a fixture in just about every neighborhood rec center, gym, and corporate wellness program in America. Hospitals, high schools, and retirement communities offer classes, and devotees flock to them to lose weight, reduce stress, ease depression, remedy back pain, and much, much more. So what can we make of yoga in the 21st century America? Joining us now is social scientist and yoga teacher Carol Horton. Carol is set to publish two books in September. One is entitled Yoga PhD, Integrating the Life of the Mind and the Wisdom of the Body. It explores the nature of contemporary yoga from her perspective as a political science professor turned yoga teacher. The other, 21st Century Yoga, Culture, Politics, and Practice. It's a co-edited collection of essays exploring yoga's relevance to contemporary social issues, including body image, eating disorders, addiction recovery, community building, political activism, and body positive spirituality. Welcome to the show, Carol Horton.
Thanks, Ann. I'm really happy to be here.
When I read that introduction that way, it feels like it touches every aspect of everybody's life these days. And it's relatively new.
Well, it's relatively new in terms of manifesting this way in American culture.
Mm-hmm.
Yoga, broadly defined as a practice, is very old, of course, and goes back to ancient India. But how we're experiencing it today in this society, yes, it's very new.
So not even 30 years ago, yoga was an exotic pursuit. When did it take off in the United States the way we know it now, and why?
In the late 1990s, there started to be a yoga boom in the United States, and that has continued through the 21st century with great verve. And I believe that the reason that it started taking off in the 1990s is that you had a new generation of American yoga teachers coming into their own. So these are people who trained with a generation of Indian master yoga teachers in the 1960s, when yoga in the United States was more associated with the counterculture. They stuck with it through the time when yoga lost all mainstream popularity in the 1980s. They developed their practice, they moved on, and then in the mid-1990s, many of them were at the point where they were ready to launch their own vision of yoga, and it was a more acculturated to American society version than what they had perhaps learned from B.K.S. Iyengar and Sri Patabi Joyce were the two major influences from India. So with that launching of, say, power yoga, a rebranding of Ashtanga yoga, the practice, the language, the cultural associations became more familiar for more Americans and opened the doors for more people being willing to try it.
What changed the most between, I guess, the 70s and the 90s in that 20-year? How did that change manifest itself in a way that we would recognize easily?
Well, I think some things changed and some things did not change. So in the 1950s, for example, yoga in the United States was popular with what we might term health nuts. So people who were very interested in healthy, holistic living, they cared about what they ate, how they exercised, and so on. And while that was not exactly mainstream, it wasn't exactly the counterculture either. Then in the 1960s, yoga became associated with the counterculture, of course, taking off with a big boom after the yoga, the Beatles went to India to study transcendental meditation in the late 1960s, and that helped launch the yoga boom. So I'd say the health focus has stayed very much the same. While yoga went into eclipse during the 80s, early 90s, the health focus is still there. That was there previously. I'd say the countercultural element has definitely diminished tremendously in the late 90s and 2000s. And what we've seen and what we're seeing now is an expansion of yoga in all the places you've mentioned, schools, hospitals, prisons, spas, resorts. So it really covers the full spectrum in a very interesting way. That is very new.
My guest is Carol Horton, social scientist turned yoga teacher. She's a contributing editor at Yoga Modern and the author of two books, author or editor of two books coming out in September. If you have a question or comment for Carol, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So, Carol, has yoga changed us as a society? It's been 20 years now since it kind of came into its own again with the new vision. Has it changed us in any way?
I'd say the jury is still out on that question. And in my view, yoga is at a crossroads today. It's become more assimilated into the mainstream culture, as we've discussed already. And I think there's a real questioning going on in the yoga community about, is yoga going to change society more, or is society going to change yoga more? What's the right balance there? How do we want that relationship to proceed? And I think that it's an open question, really, where yoga will go. In my view, yoga has changed American society, along with mindfulness practices, to the extent that there is now an acceptance of the idea that a regular practice that involves introspection and builds health on a holistic level is a reasonable idea. It's not strange, crazy, marginal, only for hippies. It's something that everyone can benefit from. I would say that's a very positive change for our society. Beyond that, I'm not sure.
Have we changed yoga? Has the essence of yoga been changed somehow by how it's been manifested, at the retail level since the 1990s?
I would say there's been a tremendous impact of mainstream American consumer culture on yoga. Of course, it gets tricky when you say, has it changed yoga? What do we mean? Do we mean the individual experience that somebody has on their mat? Well, that's always up to them. If we're speaking of it more sociologically, which is, of course, one of my huge interests, then yes, American society has changed yoga tremendously. In some ways, that's good. In some ways, that's troubling. For example, we have a huge beauty, fitness, diet, celebrity culture that's all linked. We have a tremendous concern, particularly women in our society, with the external appearance of our bodies. So yoga can and has become associated with that quest to hone a beautiful body. And the practice can easily do that in a very natural way. However, one of the troubling aspects of what's happening is that if the mindset brought to yoga stays stuck in, I need to turn my body into looking a certain way, it's actually taking you away from the deeper benefits that yoga is designed to provide and can provide.
Yes, we hear about the psychological, benefits to it, but it seems like it's a visual experience when we're learning about it.
Well, there's so much media representation of yoga now that there's a huge visual component. So there's many, many stores you can go in, for example, that sell fashionable women's clothing, and you'll see big blown-up photos of people doing yoga poses and beautiful women, beautiful young women. So, of course, we see that, and that becomes part of what we normally associate with yoga. It's on many magazine covers, YouTube videos, DVDs, and so on. So we're always surrounded by that imagery. And it's a double-edged sword. It can be inspiring for people to see someone who's very fit and beautiful, and I want to have that feeling of what it would be like to be more healthy. However, it can also be very damaging. And I really believe that the part of yoga that becomes powerful is when there is a synthesis of the mind and the body, and the mind turned in direction that is away from those external experiences and toward our own inner truth of our own experience that really is beyond the cultural moment. It's something more intrinsic to what it is to be a human being, to be alive. That, to me, is where the power of yoga really comes into play.
Most practitioners of yoga are women, 70 to 80% by some measures. You've written about the feminization of yoga and how it's become positively associated with women, but you feel like the image is one-sided. Is that what you're talking about now?
I think it's always, my approach to yoga is that there is a dual movement, a duality, a double-edged sword, however you want to put it. So the question of feminization, on one level, it's very simple. Yes, the vast majority of yoga practitioners in the United States are women. What does that mean on a deeper level? That's something I'm fascinated by and still sorting through. On the positive side, my best guess is one of the changes that's been made to the practice is that with more women coming into it, the psychological, emotional dimensions of the practice have been cultivated more consciously. So, for example, the style of yoga I practice, which is taught by Anna Forrest, is very deliberately designed to help you access your deeper emotional states and help you process your feelings and develop your intuition. So that sort of connection with feeling and intuition, I would say, culturally and perhaps beyond that, I don't know, but certainly culturally is a more quote-unquote feminine characteristic. Now, more negatively, as we've already discussed, yoga has gotten more and more bound up with the whole industry that pushes, or many industries actually, that are really pushing women to stake their identity on how they look. That I see as a problematic development.
Do you see it ever going back or changing?
I think yoga will always change because I believe for yoga to remain a powerful practice, it must speak to the society of which it's a part. And societies always change, and right now the world's changing faster than ever in terms of culture. So I believe that yoga will, of course, change. In terms of going back, I think it's a very interesting question of to what extent can contemporary yoga in North America really connect with the deeper roots of yoga in a healthy and empowering way. And by deeper roots, I would mean the tradition of Indian spiritual philosophies and practices, which are quite ancient. Again, it's a double-edged sword. I think there's so much to be learned from that tradition that it's an incredible resource that we do very well to deepen our understanding of. On the other hand, because India can also be packaged as a exotic spiritual commodity, and that's often done, it can be something that's very misleading and even lead to some cult-like dynamics in the yoga community.
My guest is Carol Horton. She's a social scientist turned yoga teacher, contributing editor at Yoga Modern, and author of two upcoming books out in September, Yoga PhD, Integrating the Life of the Mind and the Wisdom of the Body and 21st Century Yoga, and also and the Wisdom of the Body in 21st Century Yoga, Culture, Politics, and Practice. She'll stay with us when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Checking the weather forecast for Central Ohio, it's a pleasant one. A high today under sunny skies of about 90 degrees. The overnight low 65, and then on Thursday, mostly sunny. Tomorrow's high 91. By Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, weatherman saying we could get scattered thundershowers all 3 days. The temperature's dropping about 10 degrees. The high on Friday expected to be 83. Right now, 84 degrees at our studios.
Weekday mornings, prepare for the day with NPR's Steve Inskeep and Renee Montaigne, and hear local news updates from the award-winning WOSU News Team. Listen to Morning Edition weekdays from 5 until 9 a.m. on 89.7 NPR News.
Go behind the scenes of WOSU with our e-newsletters. You can find out what our Classical 101 hosts are listening to, get the latest news from the WOSU newsroom, learn about volunteer opportunities, and much, much more. The way to do it, go to wosu.org/email and sign up for one of our e-newsletters. You'll be in the loop and among the conscienti.
Yoga Yoga has never been more popular than it is now in the United States, where more than 20 million people practice the bends and the stretches and the deep breathing of the ancient discipline. It's also a multi-billion dollar business that benefits from the notion that anyone can and should do it. Joining us now to talk about the health claims and potential dangers of yoga is the award-winning author and New York Times senior science writer William Broad. A longtime practitioner of yoga, William has written a new book called The Science of Yoga, The Risks and Rewards. Welcome to the show, William Broad.
Hi, thanks, Anne. It's great to be here.
Still with us is Carol Horton, social scientist turned yoga teacher and contributing editor at Yoga Modern. Carol, once again, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Hey, Carol.
Hi.
William, your book has received a lot of attention for dispelling myths about yoga and also for how it addresses the dangers of yoga. You're a longtime yoga practitioner. Was that what you intended?
Well, I intended to try to see what science can tell us about this amazing discipline. And it tells us a lot. It shows that there are huge numbers of benefits and that they tend to be commonplace and that there are a few and very rare serious risks. That surprised me. I mean, this whole research journey kept revealing surprise after surprise. Some of the serious risks blew me away. But on the other hand, they are extremely rare. So I did yoga this morning. I've been doing yoga since 1970, and I hope I do it tomorrow. I love this stuff. I'm addicted to it. It has so many benefits and makes me feel so centered and strong and calm as a person who works a very hard job at the New York Times that I rely on it, and this book helps me understand why it's so great.
Do you think that some of the injuries and some of the risks are associated with the fact that so many people are coming out as yoga teachers, and they're kind of rolling them off the assembly line. There's millions of them. Can they all be that great? Is everybody
right.
meant to be a yoga teacher?
Right. That's definitely part of the problem. And you get people who have these sort of oversimplified ideas that one posture fits all. Everybody should be doing this posture just the way it looks on the cover of Yoga Journal. And any physiologist or any anatomy professor or expert will tell you that all our bodies are individual. We all have unique asymmetries. Males are extremely different from females in all kinds of surprising ways. You know, they don't have the same range of motion around the hip joints. They have obvious, you know, physical differences top to bottom. For teachers who try to apply the postage stamp philosophy, they should all look just like this, are, playing with fire.
Carol Horton, what about the training standards in the United States now for yoga teachers? There is no standards per se.
No, what there is Yoga Alliance, which is a nonprofit organization which many yoga teachers do pay dues and qualify to be what's called a registered yoga teacher. I have done this. To meet the basic Yoga Alliance standard, you have to do a 200-hour teacher training course that's been approved by them. Now, that said, in some parts of the country, a studio owner might ask if you're Yoga Alliance certified. In Chicago, I found that no one knew about it or cared, in my experience. Also, it's true that I do not believe that Yoga Alliance, once they approve the teacher training programs, do any sort of monitoring to check to see what the implementation of the program is actually like. And there's many programs that are not Yoga Alliance certified. It's a big topic in the yoga community, and I would say that without doubt, it's true that as yoga has become so popular, one of the ways in which studios can really make the sort of profit margin they need to stay in business is by operating teacher training programs.
That's where the big money is.
Yeah, there's a lot of people being turned out.
Right. You don't yoga teachers don't get rich, right? But if you're cranking out certifications, you can make big money, and a lot of people do.
And what's also true is that for myself, for example, as a long-term practitioner, my story was fairly typical in that at a certain point, you want to go deeper in your practice, and the next step is right now a teacher training program. And it is very, very effective. Certainly my experience was in terms of empowering you as a yoga practitioner. I learned so much by doing a teacher training. However, there's not really equivalence for people who maybe just want to go deeper, but not necessarily go out and become teachers. What's also true is that I didn't do my teacher training until I'd been practicing yoga over a decade, whereas many people I meet now have been practicing 1 or 2 years, and then they go into a teacher training program and start teaching.
Right. Well, it's also understandable. I mean, it's a great, relatively straightforward way to make a living in a bad economy, right? So, I mean, I have a lot of sympathy for, and oftentimes these people are doing, you know, good things in their communities. So I don't want to, you know, dismiss the, you know, these teachers. I've met many, many, many now, and they're, you know, they a lot of them are filled with wonderful idealism, and they're trying hard. It's just that, you know, real wisdom comes with time and experience, and that has, you know, often something they have yet to acquire.
I would also add that most yoga teachers I know are not making a good living,
right.
And it is very,
it's
very
a second,
hard.
It's a second or third job.
Scrape by as a yoga teacher, and I think that yoga teachers deserve a lot of respect for the level of commitment that they're bringing to this, because most people are doing it because they love it and because they genuinely want to share the practice with others.
Exactly.
And there are very few people who are making a decent income teaching yoga.
William Broad, what is the greatest danger of yoga? If you had to give advice to people, if something sweeping to reach the most people, what kind of advice would you give them about what to watch out for?
You know, here is the nightmare. It's unquantified, right? We don't know how frequently this happens. And believe me, I've gotten criticism for even bringing this up, but it happens. I've gotten letters from people who suffer this injury. It has to do with the blood vessels that go through your neck, and it's associated with poses like shoulder stand and plow. You can tear the inner linings of these delicate arteries that go through the vertebra, and if you do, you can suffer a stroke. If you are one of the very few unfortunates, that means that you are having part of your brain die. And there are some statistical chance that you can die overall, right? Because you're messing with some of the most primal functions of your brain. You know, is this a common threat? Absolutely not. Is it likely to happen to you? Absolutely not. But you know what? I'm a paranoid conservative person in some ways, and when I read through these studies and I saw that there was some risk, even an unquantifiably low risk, I gave up plow and shoulder stand. Mm. I just don't do them anymore. I do headstand very gingerly. You know, I've done it for a long time, since 1970, but I do it carefully, and I try to take the weight off my neck, because your neck is a delicate area of your body.
Sometimes I've been in yoga classes where it just seems like there's so many people, and not all of them, maybe it's a beginner class or an intermediate, you know, however you want to judge those, they need a lot of help, and there's just one teacher there doing it, and I was okay, but it made me nervous watching other people.
Right. That was one of the amazing things, and I write about this at the top of the injury chapter in the book, to watch Glenn Black, this very controversial and outspoken but extremely gifted master teacher in the New York region. He watched us like hawks, and it was astonishing to me to watch him in real time adjust our routine. Maybe more than half the class was yoga teachers. And he was going around, and he would see people wincing, and he'd say, okay, just loosen up a little bit there, bend your elbows a little bit, or do something, change it. And he would change things in real time based on his scrutiny and based on this sort of powerful, you know, perceptiveness that he was bringing to the class. That is rare in my experience, yet it's the thing that is, you know, most needed, especially as you become more and more ambitious in some of these postures.
My guests are Carol Horton. She's a social scientist turned yoga teacher, contributing editor at Yoga Modern, and also William Broad. He's a senior writer for The New York Times and author of The Science of Yoga, The Risks and Rewards. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. William, what is the most overrated benefit of yoga?
Overrated?
Yes.
Losing weight. Number one, right up there. If yoga does one thing well, it helps you slow down. that was my overwhelming experience at the beginning. It's the thing that everybody comes away from a yoga class with, the sense of serenity, the sense of slowing down. Well, that can be measured, and it's a metabolic slowing, and the overall effect tends to be that your metabolism slows. They've measured it's, 14%, I think, in men and about 18% in women. That means that all else being equal, if you eat the same number of calories, you will gain weight as you pick up the practice of yoga. Now, Carol and other people that do yoga and myself tend to not be heavy. If you're a serious practitioner, you manage to do excellent weight control, but that's not because of what it's doing to your metabolism. There is no magic bullet. What's happening is you're gaining self-control, you've got discipline. Stress eating is a vague memory because you are relaxed. You can turn away from the refrigerator. You don't need that candy bar or whatever, right? Because you're more relaxed. So there's all kinds of wonderful psychological repercussions of doing yoga that help you control your weight, but it's not a magic bullet for losing weight, and that is advertised over and over and over ad nauseum on the internet, in books, you name it. They just say yoga, will rev up your metabolism. It doesn't. It slows it down, and it'll help you lose weight.
I would also add that culturally, I have a lot of issues with the weight loss, quote-unquote, paradigm as something that's going to be too strongly associated with yoga. Not that I think that it's not helpful to lose weight if you need to, but the term weight loss carries with it so many cultural connotations of dieting, being a size zero, being, 6 feet tall and weighing only 125 pounds. But I would much prefer the yoga community associate itself with a term like mindful eating, mindful living. Because, in fact, as Mr. Broad just pointed out, while yoga can translate into losing weight, it's not because you're burning fat and burning calories, quote-unquote. Right. It's because it's changing your sense of being in such a way that you can eat more mindfully, that when I feel upset, I'm not going to grab that bag of potato chips and just munch through the bottom so I can get away from my problems for a while.
Right.
Or if I do, I'll catch myself and know that, that didn't make me feel very good, and tomorrow I'll do my yoga and meditation instead.
But, Carol, you have to admit that's not how it's sold, right? I mean, way too often it's revving your metabolism and, helping you magically lose weight.
Or there's it's implied that that's how it works.
Yes, it's true, and I think I am very interested in contributing to a discussion, which is ongoing among people who are very involved in yoga about these particular issues, and this is one of the biggest ones.
All right, so William Broad, what is the most underrated benefit of yoga? What do you think people don't know about or haven't heard enough about?
The last chapter of my book is entitled Muse, and it goes into creativity. This is, the chapters are ordered from kind of the strongest science to less and less science. I don't want to call it weaker, but in this creativity chapter, there's not a lot of science. But the evidence, both anecdotal and from the laboratories, is pretty overwhelming that yoga, through its magical combination of relaxation and centering and mindfulness and all these good things that it does, really, really can open the creative floodgates. That doesn't get advertised half enough as I think it ought to be. It's really good for helping you, cut through those problems and helping get a fresh perspective that you can bring to life, that you can bring to your relationships, that you can bring to your job. It's just refreshing in a spiritual way. And that, at some level, I think is deeply associated with creativity. Everybody knows that lots of Hollywood stars do yoga. But as you go back through time, you see that many of them early on, starting early in the 20th century, were doing this. I want to be alone. There are famous movie stars who were quietly doing yoga and centering and producing these dynamic careers and always going back and pulling back and centering and going into that deep well for that creative refreshment.
Carol, you agree?
I completely agree, and that's the story of what I've been doing and am doing for the past several years, coming from an academic background and then doing a lot of professional writing for nonprofits, foundation, and government. I was used to working in a very analytical way, which I love and value deeply. However, it was really yoga that inspired me to want to write in a very different way and open me up to sharing my personal experience. I've experimented with different ways of writing, and through that I've connected with other people who are doing the same thing, and I'm starting to connect with photographers and other sort of creative types who I'd say are all drawing from their practice of yoga to inspire their creative work in other fields. And it's very exciting, and I love it.
How cool.
William, sometimes I think, you know, people are intimidated. I remember the first time I went to a yoga class many years ago, I didn't even know what to wear. I thought, do I need yoga clothes? And so then once you're in there, there's a lot of levels of intimidation that may not be apparent. And
well,
how do you tell people how to make sure they're practicing safe yoga? How do you make how do you tell them to raise their hand or talk to the teacher about what they're doing?
It's hard. It's a jungle out there. And I think we're a little misled because we use the word yoga. There's really yogas, right? Hundreds, maybe thousands of them. There's so many styles. It can be very difficult. And there's the whole fitness, you know, very aggressive, competitive, athletic styles out there. You know, the Ashtangis are whipping through their sun salutations.
The hot yogas.
Yeah, the hot yogas. There's a lot of stuff. But there are, like in my community in the, you know, New England and the East Coast area here, we have Kripalu, which is a very centered, very aware style that's widely taught in my community. I'm going to go up there in the fall and talk to a teacher training class. And it's very gentle, and it works the way I learned yoga, which was paying attention, you know, paying attention to your body and doing this more as a meditation than as a competitive exercise. You know you're in trouble, I think, as a beginner if you get into a Bikram studio and you see it's mirrors. It's like a gym. Everybody's sizing each other up, and it's all, you know, it can be very competitive. Mm-hmm. And Bikram, right or wrong, wants yoga in the Olympics. You know, it's difficult, but it's out there. And it's so good. I mean, even seniors, you know, what is getting old? You get stiff and you lose your sense of balance. Every old age home, every assisted living facility, every place where there are a lot of seniors gathered together, there should be simple yoga being taught, right? Because it just has such a huge potential for improving the quality of life.
I want to grab a quick call here. Sapna in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having this program. I really appreciate what the guests have to say, and I agree with a lot of it. My whole comment was exactly like yoga is losing its meaning because of this, selfishness in a way, because you want your body to look this way or that way, and you want to be make it into a competition. I mean, it's not what that is for. I'm not an expert by any means. I do take yoga classes and things like that, but I grew up in an Indian household, and we would go to temple, and we would have some elderly sage-type people come in from India, and they would speak, and we would do a little bit of yoga. But it was more about, you know, practice of nonviolence and controlling your senses and things like that, and not getting angry. And, you know, it's I feel like yoga, the cream of yoga is that, and it's not definitely stretching, and because this is your vehicle, you want to take care of it. So I think that's secondary, where your mind and your heart and everything should be in line, and then your body comes, you know. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Yeah, you are. Thank you, Sapna. Appreciate it. William Broad, any parting thoughts on that score? I'm sorry, we've lost William Broad. I want to thank him for being with us. He is a senior writer for the New York Times, also the author of The Science of Yoga, The Risks and Rewards. When we return, Carol Horton, the social scientist turned yoga teacher, will still be with us. And we will also welcome the co-owner of Yoga on High. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Kenneth Lonergan talks about writing and directing the film Margaret, which was described in The New Yorker as nothing short of a masterpiece. It was completed in 2006, but because of lawsuits, it didn't open until last year and was shown in few theaters. Now it's out on DVD. Lonergan also made You Can Count on Me. Join us.
Fresh Air coming your way in just about 20 minutes here at 89.7 NPR News. And if you're looking for an easy way to support 89.7 NPR News, how about joining our Sustaining Giving Program? As an 89.7 NPR News sustainer, your membership never expires. No more reminders in the mail, and your WOSU member card renews annually. The ongoing support of sustaining members saves 89.7 NPR News time and money, and it helps us focus more of your support on news. Make every dollar count and become an 89.7 NPR News sustainer today. Visit WOSU.org/sustainer to sign up. And we thank you very much for your support. Currently, we have 85 sunshiny degrees in central Ohio, going for a high of 90 today, 91 for Thursday. By Friday, showers come into the scene, and we should have a high of about 83 on Friday. Saturday and Sunday, more showers, 82 and 85 respectively. Again, right now we have 85 degrees at our studios here on the Ohio State University campus. Coming up next, the rest of All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Yoga has never been more popular than it is now in the United States, where more than 20 million people practice the bends and stretches and deep breathing of the ancient discipline. It's also a multi-billion dollar business that benefits from the notion that anyone can and should do it. But not everybody can participate. Joining us now to talk about efforts to bring the benefits of yoga to others who may not think it's for them or who cannot otherwise afford it is Marcia Miller. She's co-owner of Yoga on High and director of the Yoga on High Foundation. Welcome to the show, Marcia.
Well, thank you. So happy to be here.
Also with us still is Carol Horton, social scientist turned yoga teacher, contributing editor at Yoga Modern, and author of two books coming out in September. One is Yoga, PhD, Integrating the Life of the Mind, and the other she co-edited, It's the Wisdom of the Body and 21st Century Yoga, Culture, Politics, and Practice. Once again, Carol, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Marcia, you've taught yoga for more than 35 years, so you've watched the movement grow by leaps and bounds, as Carol and I were talking about earlier. When did it start to concern you that it wasn't reaching everybody that really needed it or would want it?
Well, it's been an interest of mine since the beginning. Once I discovered the benefits that yoga had for me, I wanted everybody to experience that. And certainly in the early days, the people that came to yoga, as Carol mentioned, were people with financial ability to pay. But once we started Yoga on High, we had the means to create a foundation, and so we could really make that an effort to bring yoga to everyone.
Carol, you've talked about the idea of socially engaged yoga. Does that have anything to do with this?
Oh, it has everything to do with it. Yes. And I would say that the sort of work that is being done at Yoga on High, from looking at their website yesterday, is starting now to take off and develop a bit more of institutional profile. So, for example, just a few months ago, I went to the first conference of the Yoga Service Council, which is a new organization just formed, I think, 2 years ago, and it brings together leaders of yoga studios, nonprofit organizations, and other leaders in the community who are dedicated to bringing yoga to populations that normally could not access classes. So people in prison, people of more modest means, people perhaps in other sorts of institutions like juvenile detention centers, hospitals, and so on.
Marcia, in 2008, Yoga on High Foundation started working with communities and schools. It's a dropout prevention program.
Yes.
To develop a class for girls in urban school districts. And in 2009, you worked with 94 low-income elementary school girls in after-school and summer programs. Tell us about that and why that group.
we have yoga teachers, but we didn't have the kids. So CIS is a national organization that has programs in many schools throughout the community, and we developed a relationship in order to find schools and the kids that needed us. So it's been a really great relationship. We're still working with them, and we funded the programs in the beginning. We still provide some funding, but what's happened now is because of this collaboration, they're writing us into a lot of their grants. So we are able to receive funding from other groups who care about the health of the kids. And as you know, in this culture, we're so sedentary as a community, and the yoga part is very important for the kids to get them moving every day, to have fun, to we work with self-esteem issues, as Carol was speaking of earlier, to help kids feel comfortable who they are with their bodies, get their bodies feeling good, whatever their bodies look like. And yoga can do that. It's really powerful.
You've worked with hundreds of kids since then. How do you measure your success? How do you know it's making a difference? And it's not just a way to get out of, you know, just something to do to, you know, they might be doing something else at the same time.
We have... We ask the kids to keep journals, and we look at their journals. We have questionnaires from time to time to see what they think is important to them. And if you could see their faces and read the journals where they talk about the stress in their lives, and of course many of these kids have way more stress than just the next test. They're wondering where their next meal is going to come from, or if they're safe on their way to school, or if they're safe in their own home sometimes. They talk about the calmness that they feel from yoga, the safety, the release from tension, and their smiles. Or how you know, too. They're so full of joy. And we have those pictures, so we get to see it.
Carol Horton, you don't usually see kids in a yoga class, so I'm wondering, what do we know about how to keep kids safe in a yoga situation and make sure they do, you know, follow the instructions, mm-hmm. but in a safe way?
I don't think I can really speak to that. The youngest kids I've taught are some preteen boys in a foster care facility. I do feel that yoga needs to be adapted for every population. And as you get into, say, teaching young children, I believe that you need some specialized training to do so appropriately, and I have not done that training.
So how do you yeah. work on that, Marcia?
So our teachers do have specialized training. Absolutely. The child's body is very different from the grown-up's body. It's not fully developed. Their minds are not fully developed in the same way. So we have a lot of fun. It's simple things. There are certain poses we don't do because their bodies are not ready for it. And it's based on moving the body. The poses are named after animals, many of them. So we create the relationship to animals and things they might know about. And keep it fun and definitely very safe.
Yoga on High Foundation has funded an ongoing 6-week sessions of therapeutic yoga classes for homeless veterans in Columbus and Central Ohio. What do we know about the benefits of yoga for veterans?
Actually, there's a tremendous amount of research being done here by our government as well as other groups. And this is the class probably right now that's most dear to my heart because I get to teach it. And we know... a lot of research also being done through some of the presenters at Kripalu, which William Broad mentioned. There's tremendous research about post-traumatic stress disorder and the kinds of stresses. And in the case of my guys, they've all had some addiction issues that yoga can really help with that.
And then you also designed a yoga curriculum for women with breast cancer as part of a research study at Ohio State
yeah.
University. What happened with that?
We have just finished the last group of students, so now we're into the data. We've collected the data, now we're into the data study. So the results will be out next year sometime. I know from teaching some of the students there, and they had a number of different teachers teach, although I designed the study, that anecdotally the women loved it. And I could see a huge difference in them from the beginning to the end of the 12 weeks.
Carol Horton, for some of these groups, particularly for like the kids who otherwise couldn't afford to go, or anybody, the homeless veterans, how do you, what is the idea about the buy-in? If they're not paying for it, how do you know that they're buying into it? Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I can only speak from my own experience mm-hmm. and from others I've talked to who have done this sort of work. And I've found that the level of buy-in is, on the whole, even more profound with these populations than with, say, your normal studio population. And by more profound, I mean when I've taught, I volunteer to teach in the women in the Cook County Jail with a local nonprofit called Yoga for Recovery. And our classes are so popular that their spaces are rationed because more people want to sign up to go than, unfortunately, we have the ability to offer classes to fill the full demand. And from teaching those classes, I would say that these women, they're in jail. They know that they're in a bad place in their lives. And when they're offered something that can really help them on a deep level and a holistic level, help them feel better physically, help them access some calm, help them reconnect with that deeper part of themselves, which remains beautiful and strong and vital. A good yoga class can do that, and they are ready to grasp at those tools. Whereas sometimes in a studio class, there can be more of a mentality of, look, I'm here for my workout, and that's all I want. Thanks very much. And people don't necessarily have the same need. So I think, now, that said, young children I have not taught, and maybe getting them herded into a class situation, I think requires a certain level of skill. But having worked with adults in a homeless shelter, with teen girls in a foster care facility, preteen boys, and women in jail, I would say all those populations were very, very receptive to taking a yoga class, and it's just unmistakable as a teacher.
Marcia, one of the things that Yoga on High is raising money for, or the Yoga on High Foundation is raising money for, is the Mindfulness Prison Project. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. One of our teachers is working with women at Marysville Prison, where I also taught a number of years ago. And I concur with Carol's comments. Absolutely. They are really eager for anything that will help them. Creating a meditation program for these women to help them work with the skills that they may not have gotten as kids, to calm themselves, to deal with stress and conflict, to feel good about themselves, and to deal with the struggles that they have in their life. And there's tremendous amount of research of mindfulness meditation practices in the literature. And we're eager to do more of that in this prison.
You said it was devised at the prison's request, and it targets residents of the reintegration dorm. So that's one that's where they're getting ready to
So you're getting
to
ready
out.
To go home. You might have anger issues. You might be getting your kids back or hoping to get your kids back. A lot of these women are inspired by the idea of being reunited with their children. And so how do they have skills to cope with the really very real difficulties that they'll have coming back out into the community?
And then mindfulness for teens, the same thing, but for kids, and it's targeting eighth graders.
Well, and this is very exciting. There's lots of different kinds of meditation. And this teacher, Mary Beth Hamilton, has the idea that to take the meditation practice right where the kids are. And so she'll be working with music and helping them find music that they enjoy, music that is calming for them. And so they don't have to sit and be quiet. They can be engaged with something they love like that and develop the same skills through the healing benefits of music.
Oh, you know, Carol Horton and Marcia Miller, we have a few questions that have rolled in via email, and they're just kind of off topic, but they're about yoga. So I guess it's on topic. Matt writes, I tried yoga when I was 25 years old. I would consider myself physically fit, having played football and baseball my entire life and practicing cardio and weightlifting each week since I stopped playing. However, the first time I tried yoga, I ended up hurting my lower back so bad that I spent the next month and a half visiting a chiropractor. It cost me thousands of dollars. The pain was so bad that I could not sit, lay down, drive, or even move without it taking away my breath. 2 years later, I still have problems with my back and occasionally have to visit the chiropractor for an alignment. I would advise folks, even those who are used to more physically involved exercises, to be cautious of the amazing power of yoga. Any thoughts, Carol Horton?
Well, first, I'm sorry that that was his first exposure to yoga. But absolutely, look, people can get injured in a yoga class. And we discussed some of this earlier with William Broad. Mm-hmm. He discussed some of the more catastrophic possibilities. But this sort of instance, like hurting your low back, is probably what's much more common. I actually have a friend who works in a wellness center at a university doing movement therapy. And she says she has students, so these are, of course, people in their 20s, fairly healthy, coming in pretty much every week with yoga injuries. And they're not life-threatening strokes, but they're serious and can impact your quality of life. And so I think that it's very important to remember that you must listen to your body, that there's many different styles of yoga out there, and you need to find what's right for you. Some classes will be too vigorous or advanced for some people. For some people, that's the right thing. And so there is a certain sort of undeniable difficulty when it comes to first getting started in yoga, figuring out the terrain, figuring out the right class for your body where you are right now. So I think people have to be very definitive that if they don't feel good in this class, they should feel free to talk to the teacher about why. If it doesn't seem right, they should go try a different class, try a different method, try a different teacher. Keep going until you find something where you feel good physically, you feel safe on all levels, physical, psychological, and spiritual, if that is meaningful to you. And if you keep looking, you will find something that works for you.
Pam in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you. First of all, I'd like to commend your two speakers for their work with women in prison, because I think that's a very vulnerable population that would benefit enormously from yoga techniques. I just wanted to say I've tried yoga twice. One, several years ago, I did something called Sahaj Yoga, which is primarily a meditative yoga. Mm-hmm. It has a lot of health benefits in terms of lowering blood pressure and boosting the immune system. And the thing I liked about it was anybody in a wheelchair could perform this. But you don't have to be in physically good condition for that. What I'm doing now is I'm watching stretches with Priscilla. She comes out of South Carolina ETV. She has a couple of shows on in the morning and some cities in Ohio. And she does tell you, you know, what to do to protect your back. She mentions certain stretches shouldn't be done if you have hypertension or chronic neck problems. And I go at my own pace, and what I've noticed with this, I knew it would help my flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know it would help my strength and my balance.
Right.
And being 60 years old, that's important to me because I see people in my mother's generation who suffer a lot of falls with a lot of injuries to head and hips. And I think a lot of that is created by lack of strength and lack of balance, lack of mobility and lack of exercise. And these are all things that, you know, had they started yoga even as late in life for me, I think would vastly benefit one as one ages. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Pam, for your call. I also want to thank Carol Horton for joining us today. Carol, thanks so much.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Carol Horton, social scientist turned yoga teacher. She's a contributing editor at Yoga Modern and author of two books coming out in September. You can learn more about those when you go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Also, Marcia Miller, co-owner of Yoga on High and director of the Yoga on High Foundation. Thanks for joining us, Marcia. I want to just mention that there is a summer soiree fundraiser for the Yoga on High Foundation. To learn more, you can go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Tickets are still on sale. It's this Saturday, July 14th. So check it out. And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Great. Yeah.
I would have had to do a bit of a shot.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate that. I figured it would be the last tack on, so that's fine.